No one would have believed in the last years of the 19th century that this world was being watched keenly and closely by intelligences greater than man's and yet as mortal as his own, that as men busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied, perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. With infinite complacency, men went to and fro over this globe about their little affairs, serene in their assurances of their empire over matter. It is curious to recall some of the mental habits of those departed days. At most, terrestrial men fancied there might be other men upon Mars, perhaps inferior to themselves and ready to welcome a missionary enterprise. Yet across the gulf of space, minds that are to our minds as ours are to those of the beasts that perish, intellects vast and cool and unsympathetic, regarded this Earth with envious eyes, and slowly and surely drew their plans against us.
Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borak Thung, Earthlitz, and welcome to the 2008 Thrillcast, where this time we are talking Scarlet Traces, the anthology. Out now in hardcover from Rebellion Publishing. It's an anthology of tales set in the world originally created by H.G. Wells, but taken on by Ian Edgington and Matt Disraeli Brooker in their series for 2000 AD. This is a prose anthology in which various writers take the ideas of what happens after H.G. Wells's seminal sci-fi novel and explore the world in different ways to how Ian and Matt have explored it in 2000 AD. Absolutely fascinating anthology of different viewpoints out now, which you can get. So we're going to talk to Ian Edgington, writer Maura McHugh, and Rebellion editor David Moore later on. But don't forget that this week it is a jumping on issue for 2000 AD, Prog 2150. If you want to read 2000 AD, or you've not read 2000 AD for a while, and you want a point at which to come back on where all the stories start at number one, this is the issue for you. So we've got Dread, we've got The Return of Hope and Brink, we've got The Fall of Dead World, we've got Sinister Dexter, we've got Defoe makes his return after some time with a new artist, and we've got Future Shock as well. It's an absolutely packed bumper issue. $4.99 from all good newsagents or digitally from 2000 AD's web shop and apps. Make sure you jump on the thrill power train, Earthlitz, as we power our way through the next 6 months of the galaxy's greatest comic. And we'll be here on the Thrillcast to hold your hand and introduce you to some of the creators and some of the background to these amazing stories and the collections that we're putting out as well. So welcome to new listeners. Welcome to well-established listeners. Don't forget to leave us a little review on iTunes or the podcast apps of your choice. 5 stars would be lovely, but it's entirely up to you. Thank you for all the support that everyone's given us, both in listening and shares and talking about the podcast. It is hugely appreciated, and we wouldn't be here without you. Now, moving on to the subject for this episode, Scarlet Traces, the anthology, which is, like I said, a series of short stories set in H.G. Wells' world, as adapted by Ian Edgington and Matt Brooker. And it's wonderful to be able to explore different worlds in a different way, working in prose rather than comics. And Rebellion Publishing is perfectly positioned to be able to do this as we work together to bring you more from your favourite series. So to talk about the Scarlet Traces anthology, it's fantastic to welcome on Skype editor of the book, Ian Edgington.
Hello.
One of the writers on the book and a former Thrillcast guest, Maura McHugh.
Hello.
And in the booth, we've got... have you been a guest on here before, David?
Some point.
Yeah, a long time ago. David Moore, who's the chief editor at Rebellion Publishing.
My title is fiction commissioning editor.
Oh, my God. Right.
Yes, g'day.
Hello. So many titles. Hello, everybody. I'm Mike.
Hello, Mike.
Hi. Hi. Anyway, let's talk about Scarlet Traces. So, Ian.
Yes.
You and Matt Brooker Disraeli created Scarlet Traces, set it in the world of H.G. Wells. Do you want to just go over a bit of the history of the creation of Scarlet Traces and how it came to be at 2000 AD?
Blimey, how long you got? Well, it was an initial idea from way back when I had just, you know, what happened to the Martian technology, the Victorian reverse engineer. It's like, oh, okay. And then it kind of sat in a drawer for ages until I kind of built up a bit of a comics career. Initially, it was going to be for Tundra UK, I do believe. And then they kind of folded. And so we hopped it over to Cool Beans that was up in Sheffield.
My God, Cool Beans.
Yes. And they kind of folded.
Yeah. I sent a pattern.
When did you
Matt and I become the Typhoid Mary of comics.
Well, I was just about to say, when did you begin to think that it might be cursed?
Yes. And so then we actually took it to Dark Horse. And I think they liked the idea because, you know, it was already paid for and stuff anyway, so they got a mini-series for now. But also the War of the Worlds movie was coming up, the Steven Spielberg one, so they asked us to adapt War of the Worlds as well. And then we pitched the sequel to them, and they went, oh, okay. So we had the kind of three books that they did in nice uniform editions. We tried to get some more done, and the phone line kind of went dead. I think, you know, I don't know if they weren't interested or they were just too busy or whatever. So it kind of came back to us, and so we pitched Scarlet Traces to Rebellion, and I think it was when David Bishop was there, and they ran it in the and Barnes, they ran it in the magazine, and we had to do a couple of extra pages, which was nice to fill the length. And then further on down the road, Matt and I decided that we wanted to do more, and the best place to do it will be at Rebellion, because, you know, pitching it as a miniseries again to the States, we might only get about another six issues out of it, but we had more stories to tell. It was a big universe to kind of play in. So we kind of struck a deal where we kind of sold it to the All Good Selves, and we get to do more stuff, which is where we are today.
So for those who are newcomers to the world of Scarlet Traces, sum it up in a paragraph for us.
Okay, it's set 10 years after the aborted Martian invasion. The Victorians, I had it where the Martians just invaded the UK as like a bridge, an island bridgehead. They didn't invade the rest of the world. And so the Victorians have got hold of the technology, they reversed engineered it, and it's basically strengthened the Empire's hold on the world for decades to come. And the initial story is a murder mystery set against that background with a gentleman adventurer, Robert Altman, and his butler, Archie Curry, who was his sergeant in the army.
Brilliant. Perfect. Wonderful. Let me come to David, because the Scarlet Traces anthology, which is what we're talking about today, is a series of pro short stories set in the H.G. in Ian and Matt's world within H.G. Wells's world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What was the thinking behind this anthology?
It was Ian's idea. But, so Ian and I had been talking about a novel for a while. That sort of project went on and off the hob a few times. But Ian just started saying, well, what about an anthology? That'd be quite cool. And I'm like, wow, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what sort of the numbers really add up there. We were grinding the numbers, taking a look and thinking maybe it's something to think about as a back burner possibility. And it reminded me of it a couple more times. Then he dropped me an email saying, I've got Stephen Baxter. And I was like, okay, well, let me get the contract out. That's basically the story, isn't it? It's of, we went from there.
Ian, how did you get Stephen Baxter?
He was signing Massacre of Mankind in Waterstones, and I kind of like trotted up and said, oh, you know, I like your books. And he knew who I was. He'd actually referenced Scarlet Traces in, I think, an address to the Wells Society or something like that. And so
nice.
He knew who we were, and he liked kind of what we'd done, the sociological backdrop and stuff. And I mentioned it, and he went, yeah, fine. And we traded a few emails, and they said, can I put you in touch with Professor Adam Roberts as well, because he's writing Wells's biography. Oh, go on then. And it kind of like those two kind of names then kind of clinched. I mean, we had a bit of a snowball effect then when, you know, names attracted names and things. And so and we're in touch now, Stephen and I. It's just really nice. He was really lovely. So they put him on something like 2 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon. So there's hardly anybody about, which was just ridiculous. So we just ended up standing around chatting for the afternoon, which was great.
So tell us a little bit about the intent of this anthology. You know, are these stories that will be that are fleshing out the world or saying particular things about the world?
I say to everybody that the mini series the series that we've got is canon, basically. So that's the spine of it. So you can take whatever you want from there and kind of wander off with it. Don't go completely bizarre. You know, if you have some really outrageous stuff, let me know. But otherwise, just, you know, here's the toy box, off you go. You know, here's the Lego set, go and make something of your own. Because there's, Matt and I realise there is tons of stuff to get going on in that world now, because we broadened it out. Each series moves on by like a decade or so. So we went to the 40s and now to the 60s and so on. And so
gave people lots of space.
There's so much other peripheral material going on in the, you know, has it affected life in Australia or America? And so I just said to Matt, should we just let other people take the baton and kind of run with it and see what they come up with? And that's what we did, basically. We just said it's a, you know, open field. The miniseries are the core and stuff. Pick what you want and go nuts, basically.
Yeah, anthologies really benefit from a broad canvas. It's one of those kind of threading the needle things, because a tight concept really helps market the book. But some people want to know what the idea is behind the book they're picking up. But writers get more creative when they've got space to think. So having something really pithy that grabs you in a sentence or two, like, you know, what if the British Empire appropriated Martian technology and used it to reinforce their power base, and then just sort of give them the whole world and all of time to play with, well, all of the 20th century, roughly.
When you're faced with such a broad canvas, I mean, as you say, it's the world. Do you stop it from being almost scattergun, that any people can choose literally anything they want to do? How do you keep, do you want to keep like a common thread, a kind of common sense of this all fitting into a whole?
I let people kind of run free. I mean, like Ian Corbett's stories, INJ Corbett's story is a classic example where it's, you know, about ant-headed men in black in the desert. And it's just kind of this kind of David Cronenberg kind of Burroughs kind of bizarre story there. And it's like, but it fits in and it's great. So it just goes to show that, you know, the Scar Trace thing is like a broad church. You can fit quite a few things into it. And it's been interesting to see what people have come up with. You know, so we've got T.S. Eliot on Mars, which is great.
That's
amazing. Which I never would have thought. And so it's
consider Flobbo. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it's, you know, I've laughed out loud quite a few times reading some stuff thinking that. Part of me goes, well, why didn't I think of that? Shit.
Maury, do you want to tell us about your short story within the anthology?
Okay. It's got an interesting title. It's the Mechanical Marionette Mob, and it's about a woman called Dr. Belsa Sullivan, who runs this puppet company in a theatre in Soho with the help of her assistant Waldo Austin. And it's actually kind of about technology, the fact that everyone in Europe is essentially trying to set up in London. That's the way I kind of knew, figured would happen. If you look at the way, you know, around the world, how technology attracts people in. So London, I assumed, and it's set in 1937, I should specify. So, you know, it's all about people who are coming in from all over the empire and the Commonwealth, and who are actually, the Commonwealth wouldn't really exist exactly the same way. But anyway, let's just say the empire. And then there, you know, there's another person called Gisela, who has a different type of technology that's emerging in Europe. And that was based off, there's a lot of allusions to films, existing characters, and other concepts. And these two people, the puppet show is automated. They're mechanical puppets that have no strings. And so Belsa's, you know, an engineer, and she's very into technology and into using it to benefit people, because Waldo actually doesn't have an arm, so she's built his prosthetic. So there's, I was kind of thinking a lot about that, and also just about the impact that this has just on an ordinary level. Like, you know, I'm very, going into an alternate world like this is actually really, funny enough, it took a lot of time, because you have to look at the time that would have happened, the 37, say in my case, and then you have to look at the changes that were made, and then try to extrapolate and to imagine new versions of the world if major events didn't happen. For instance, World War I doesn't happen. So that's a massive influence in our society. So just thinking about that actually took a lot of time, pardon me, to get the characters and to think about what we do. And also, I'm a real mythology nut. So I actually thought a lot about what this would mean to the Martians being repelled by the British Empire, how this would resonate on a mythic level as well. So I kind of threaded in a whole mythological element into the story.
And what was your reaction when Ian came to you to be part of the book?
Yeah, I was excited, intimidated in a way, because the thing is, if somebody has developed this world and then says, go in, and I don't mind where you go in, it's actually really, I think that was the hardest thing for me, was just to decide where to insert my story. And then I started noodling around with a few ideas. And of course, I do love a whole, you know, mashing up literary and fictional characters. It's very exciting to go in and just, you know, develop your own little patch, hoe your little patch of garden and see what weird flowers grow up. And Ian, thankfully, liked what my very strange garden.
One thing I'm fascinated about with Scarlet Traces, and have been since I read it in the magazine, is this notion of a continuation of a very well-known story. So, you know, the plot of H.G. Wells's War of the Worlds is, you know, one of those sci-fi plots that everybody knows. Aliens come along, invade. Spoilers for anybody who's not read it, because you never know. They eventually lose because they hadn't thought about disease, so they all get the common cold.
There's spoilers
and,
again.
Yeah, well, no, the whole thing is spoilers. I said it once. If people keep listening, that's their own fault. So it's fascinating to then take it forward, and I'm curious about the whole. And David, I'll get your opinion on this as well. About this idea of taking a story onwards, what elements you keep, what elements you drop, what elements you introduce. And with something like Scarlet Traces, it seems like a perfect one to discuss something like that. And I guess Ian, you're the ideal person to speak to about it. I'm curious about that process you went through in creating this world within a world, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, because the temptation initially is just, you know, it's a Martian invasion story and, you know, fight and all that kind of, but the thing that struck me was kind of the sociological kind of an economic kind of impact that, you know, having that technology would make a lot of people unemployed. So we have, you know, the parts of the country is mass unemployed. And so it's how it's the ripples it sends out. For example, at the end of the original novel, it's stated that the Martian cylinders are seen heading toward Venus, and so there's the whole fact that they, you know, they occupied Venus, and you have refugees coming from Venus who, and in the city, arriving in the 60s in the UK and so on. So again, there's all like social tensions, and so it's kind of, you pull that one end of the thread and it starts to unravel whole other kind of like plot threads and ideas The British invade Mars in their own kind of version of Vietnam because they need a good war, a bit like the Falklands kind of thing, to kind of like boost political esteem. And so it's quite interesting how many kind of like modern day allegories you can apply to that story once you start pulling the threads out and exposing all the bits. It's not just kind of simply, you know, Martians invade and there's all, you know, it's not a big blockbuster movie. There's a lot more kind of like smaller, intricate moments in there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, there is a sort of a strong thread criticising imperialism in the whole Sir Scarlet Tracy's universe, starting right at the very beginning with the Scottish independence movement being sort of a big part of the initial storyline, and then all the way through with these sort of kinds of ideas of British expansionism and arrogance, and the way the rest of the world reacts. It's interesting, and I think it's very timely with to our world today, and also very relevant to the ideas informing the original world story.
Well, that was something I wanted to come on to.
Do you want my answer to that last question first, then?
Oh yeah, go on. Sorry,
What was it again? It was
what elements to keep, what elements to leave, things like that.
So my own experience probably is going to break away from Scarlet Tracy's. Last year, I did a prequel to Dracula and a sequel to Frankenstein, both as anthologies. And it was interesting to what extent, working with the authors who were the ones making most of these decisions, it was a process of curating more than anything else. You start from the position of what story do you want to tell here, and then work out how that relates to the source material in a way. So we had, from the Dracula collection, a writer who's part Romani background herself, talking about the experience that the gypsies in the original Dracula novel had, what their side of that story was, of the Dracula story was, and what effect it had in the longer run going from there. Frankenstein, I had a writer looking at the experience of a subject of the Empire, an Asian boy growing up in London and living in a time not long after the events of the novel. So there's different... They seem to sort of start very much from the point of view of what story do I want to tell, and how does that engage with the original material?
Okay, let's talk about the themes a little bit in Wells and how this anthology picks up on certain threads of that. Ian, one of the reasons I like Scarlet Traces is because it takes one of this kind of themes of War of the Worlds, which is what if the British were the ones being invaded, how would they like it? And shows the British Empire not learning that lesson at all. And again, this is a spoiler for anybody who hasn't read The Great Game, which was the second series you did with Dark Horse, then overextends itself against their enemy and gets their backsides kicked. Tell us a bit about your intent of dealing with that theme and how it's been taken on, and in this anthology, how the different writers have taken themes that you thought of for Scarlet Traces and perhaps ones that you didn't think of and were surprised by.
Wow, big question. because the Scarlet Traces world is so big, everybody came up with really, you know, unique standalone ideas. And also they didn't tread on each other's toes as well because there's such a big timeline. So that worked out quite nicely. It kind of like comes back about, I don't like bullies, basically. And, you know, the Empire took the British took the technology to extend their strength, and it kind of like they fell foul of their kind of ambition in the end, their overreaching ambition. And so it's it was that what I kind of like wanted to point out in the stories. It's a broad sweep, but I wanted to kind of keep the stories on a personal level. So that's why the last series that ran in 2008 called Homefront is the story of Venetian refugees, a journalist, and other people just basically on the ground when a second invasion is happening, and it's told through their kind of point of view, because I think that's it's you know, we've seen so many on TV, you know, scenes, you know, in the Middle East, and it's just wanted to keep it there, I don't know, a personal point of view from such a big land. My words aren't working, but yeah, so there you go.
Okay. Well, because Nathan Duck's story sort of personalises that even further. Yes. to a literal schoolyard bully, you know, to a Venusian boy in an English school, sort of having to, in fact, Nathan's own school, I think, which is quite sweet, having to deal with kind of institutional bullying within school.
Yeah, Nathan's a friend who actually I met at some site, and we got together and threw ideas around, and we've been mates. He came to a signing at Forbidden Planet, and we've kind of been mates ever since. And he's the idea that he had when he kind of pitched it to me, and I just went, that I really love that, because it's growing up in, I grew up in Smethwick in like the 60s and 70s, which there was it was a huge multicultural place, and just to actually see that reflected in the story. I mean, he did a really good job, and as he's a head of English Handsworth Grammar, and so kind of he's got like on the ground intelligence with the way the kids are. I just love this story, and it's
brilliant.
Yes. And were there any takes that particularly surprised you in the anthology?
I think Ian's, again, I come back to Ian Corbodon, because he was kind of so kind of left of field. I think, where are we going here? What does this actually have to do with the Scarlet Traces? And then it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I can see what he's doing. But it was, it kind of took me by surprise. And again, the Adam Roberts
had to talk about without spoilers.
Yeah, sorry. That, well, there was a nice twist in that as well, which is like, okay. Everybody came up with their own take, which was, you know, a unique take, which was great, which is what we're after. So yeah. I was kind of pleased with the way it all turned
Dan's
out.
Dan's story, The Alarmist, as well, talking about sort of populist media and sort of the role of the news in our lives.
Mm. Mm. Maura, were there was your idea for your story one that came fully formed, or were there aspects that you wanted to explore in the world that you couldn't necessarily do so with the story that you ended up telling?
I'm trying to be careful here, because some stuff I'm trying not to. It might sound like I'm being coy, but I'm trying not to say particular things. The character of Belsa is actually partly inspired by a real person, and whose life was fascinating, who was contemporaneous to Belsa, and lived an amazing life in England. So I was trying to look at people who are not, you know, I just imagined, you know, London would be this hive of excitement, also on an arts level, which is why it starts with it's got a puppet show starting. And then, you know, running with that. But I started with people and then noodled beyond it. And the story actually surprised me, in that I kept thinking, I tend to write your standard like 5,000 to 6,000 words, but this actually is longer than I normally write. And it kept sort of wanting to be longer, which I would tend to resist, because I'm more, especially writing for comics, I always have a kind of an efficiency quality running. But sometimes, you know, a story just says, oh, no, I actually need to be longer. And then you just have to let go of the reins and let it run a bit. So this story is, by my standards, for a short fiction of this type, is longer than I normally write. But I really enjoyed it. And I was also, the stuff that Ian had done, really I love about the stories is actually the whole politics and the sociological, part of it. Because actually science fiction is a thought experiment, and that's what you do. You create a little thought experiment and then you run with it. And then you just question how people would react. It's actually kind of like a scientist with mice in a maze, and you just run them around and you go, oh, look, they're bouncing off each other in a very strange way. What's that? And then you kind of push into there. So, I really, and I actually, the whole thing in the first Scarlet Traces about Scotland, I found very interesting. The impact, how some parts, even, you know, some parts of the empire, which were very close, were completely just destroyed in the pursuit of the of one part of the empire, you know, which is a pretty common, you know, resources are required, you know. So, yeah, I really enjoyed, you know, going into the world. It was a lot of fun.
Let's talk about the legacy of H.G. Wells, because, you know, the university agreed to be one of the founders of science fiction as we know it. But there are and have long been, as we've touched on, elements of his worldview and the worldview of many other kind of founding fathers, essentially, of science fiction that have stuck around for a long time. And they're only really, to a certain extent, now being dealt with. David, I want to come to you first because we did an anthology called Not So Stories.
Oh, yes.
Which dealt with the colonial attitudes and legacy of
Rudyard Kipling's
yeah. Just So Stories. With someone like H.G. Wells, because they are such a founding element of science fiction, how do we now in the 21st century, as we are dealing with the legacy of colonialism, the legacy of imperialism, deal with that in fiction? How do we essentially decolonialize science fiction?
I feel I'm probably too white to answer this question. It's partly about picking up these creators and looking at them really frankly. Mm. A lot of the time, there's an understandable movement to just discard them and say we don't need that anymore, and I sympathise, and certainly in some cases that's the right answer. But sometimes what we need to do is pick up, to use an online phrase, our problematic faiths, and look at what we like about them and what's worth preserving, and bluntly and honestly discuss what was problematic about them. Lovecraft especially, this is a huge conversation, because he was a blistering racist, even by the standards of his time. We have plenty of correspondence with his peers going, mate, you're being very racist, please rein that shit in. But at the same time, there's lots of creators, including writers of colour from all around the world, that are using the kind of the really rich, powerful ideas of cosmic horror that he founded and using it for themselves and recreating it. And that's the third and I think most important part of decolonisation, is listening to marginalised voices, is listening to sort of looking at the British Isles voices from Ireland and Scotland and saying, what does being part of the United Kingdom mean to you? But looking at people who are the sort of second and third generation immigrants from those big influxes in the 60s and 70s and the 80s and 90s and saying, what does it mean to grow up? So like Nikesh Shukla's The Good Immigrant, which specifically gave a voice to people who are British, have grown up British as children of immigrants, and had to deal with that kind of "you're a good immigrant provided you can win the Great British Bake Off" kind of concept. But yeah, so that's a voice. And then people from further afield, and actually a large part of the point of Not So Stories was to give a voice to people who specifically grew up outside the UK, who for whom British culture was at least in part represented by this collection of stories. And most of the people that submitted to that collection loved the Just So Stories as children, and then grew up and read them again and went, yeah, okay, there's some attitudes in here that put my place in this world in a very different position from what I see myself as, and who got a chance to engage lovingly but critically with that that legacy.
Ian, Maura.
The funny thing is that all my grandparents were born, were British citizens. So this, because they were born prior to 1922. And so it's like, The the impact of colonization in my country is something I think about a lot, and has actually appeared quite a bit in my fiction. But, you know, you can't tell that, say, directly on the nose. There's ways of discussing it. I did consider setting a Scarlet Traces story in Ireland, but actually it sort of didn't gel. But maybe I should do that if there's another one, if you fancy it. But anyway, but yeah, it's a very interesting thing to look at it from, because my grandfather actually had, he was very young, of course, when the War of Independence happened here and the war prior to that. But he actually had very, very terrible memories, which he told me. So he had firsthand experience of all of that. So it's something that's within our history here, and which is still has effects today, considering what's going on currently with Northern Ireland,
Ian, with something where you're talking about an alternative history where, you know, you had this alien invasion, the British reverse engineered the technology, allowing them to dominate the globe in a way that at that point in history was starting to decline. The British influence in the globe was starting to decline. They're only a few decades away from the breakup of the empire. When you're doing an alternative history, what's your thought process in terms of, again, what you choose to leave and what you choose to change? And I'm particularly thinking about in the context of what Maura was just talking about with the Irish, you know, an all-powerful and resurgent British Empire at that exact moment in history, the dawn of the 20th century. You know, you're undoubtedly talking about the Irish Civil War and the Irish War of Independence not happening. As a writer, you know, what's the process behind the bits of history that you leave in and the bits of history you take out?
I wish I could be very intelligent and say I had it all planned out and thought out, but there was a great degree of winging it. It was just like, it was that the initial idea about what, you know, the invasion and the technology, and thought, oh, that's a good idea. And it's like from Little Acorns did kind of monumental kind of tree grow that did, it was actually the writing of the stories as they went on that kind of more and more made you think, okay, well, what would happen? You know, how would it affect? You know, what we have the big manufacturing estates in the north and in Scotland that leads to massive unemployment because they're all automated, and so it's kind of little. It was like little bits that kind of fed out from the main story, and it's only as the story's gone on now I've actually kind of consciously thought, okay, what are we going to deal with here? So, for example, in the latest couple of series, we do have the Venusian refugees living in like inner city Birmingham and things like that, and what life was like. And so I've had to do a lot more kind of like research and just digging up and talking to friends from school and so on about their experiences. I grew up with my friend's family, a big Irish family in Birmingham at the time of the pub bombings. And it was kind of the public's response to basically anybody Irish in the city, that, you know, that they were spat on when they went to school, and it was quite an eye-opener then. And it's kind of like all that just like fed into the experience of in the story. Basically, to get back to the point, I've tried to keep the main thread of the invasion and the Martians invading again and going through it, but it's there's like peripheral stories of the single characters and how they interact with the big events of their world and how it impacts on their personal lives, the day-to-day stuff of being a refugee as well, now that England's been invaded again. And of course, refugees have been such a big thing in the news the last like decade or so, and it's just how it reflects in the story. It's hard to quantify.
War of the Worlds is such a pivotal moment in the evolution of science fiction, but also a very interesting point in history to have a story about invasion where the empire was at its absolute height. You know, Queen Victoria had been on the throne for decades and decades. Everything seemed very stable. But at the same time, you're starting to see the cracks appear in that as you go towards the end of the Victorian period. That kind of brings me on to an element I wanted to talk about. See, we've done this. A lot of people have done this. Describe Scarlet Traces as steampunk. Now, you look at Matt Brooker's incredible work, and absolutely, you go, oh, yeah, there's very clearly steampunk. Look, it's got all this amazing kind of brass and copper technology. Lots of people wearing goggles. but steampunk in of itself, it's a difficult subgenre, isn't it? Because it's an aesthetic. It's not necessarily a literary genre that started. It was an aesthetic, and it has gone on to become something. Well, I mean, David, what you're kind of looking at the ceiling, nodding and shaking your head at the same time.
It's tricky because obviously, in large part, steampunk depends on some of the early works by Moorcock, very much on the Difference Engine, the Gibson Stirling anthology. So we've got, we've got a literary heritage there, and actually, from one point of view, you'd have to call Scarlet Traces Victoriana because the original text is itself Victorian. It was written during that time. But when you consider that what defines steampunk now is a sort of speculative interpretation of what a more advanced Victorian technology would look like, coupled with ultimately a criticism of empire, that is Scarlet Traces. So it's an interesting one to argue. I don't know.
Ian, what's your take on it?
What David said. Yeah, I mean, the danger is with steampunk is like the romanticisation of the images of empire, you know.
Yeah.
But you have to factor in all the terrible stuff that happened as well. And that's why we tried to do the stuff with Scotland and so on, is to say, you know, this is what the price of, living in a prosperous British Empire, this is the price was paid by all these other people. And it's kind of... I hesitate to bring up the B word, but it's kind of got that Brexit feel to it. Where it's, you know, there is very much of people saying, you know, oh, we struggled through the war or this, you know, it's a kind of a little England kind of attitude that, it was good back then. But yeah, it was good for so many people, but for a lot of other people, it certainly wasn't. You know, it was paid for with their blood, sweat and tears kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you are doing steampunk, you can't really ignore that. And I know there's been a trend now, I can't remember some names, but to bring in the other cultures' view of like steampunk. And so that's, you know, so it's opening up. So we get other worldviews.
Indian and steampunk.
Because that's always a funny thing about empire, which is it's completely, you know, is that if you create an empire and your hub is London, then of course your other citizens around the world are going to go to London. So it's like it's always that funny thing. It's of we'll go around the world and civilize everyone. Hang on, what do you mean you want to come here?
But I mean, we welcomed the subjects of empire, didn't we? That was sort of a big characteristic of the late 19th century. There were people from all over the world living here.
And actually, that's one of the things. One of my characters is his background is, and you know, to me that's normal because London was hugely diverse. Every time I go there, it's incredible. It's really lively and energetic and dynamic, and it's a wonderful city. But it's a wonderful city that's based on the input of many, many people, and that's the thing that I think is you know, that's the future. That's the way we go. That's how we progress. That's how we evolve.
Yeah, I'm reminded of there was a bit of a spat between I think Michael Stuckbury, the historian, and Paul Joseph Watson. The BBC had just put this animated clip of Roman soldiers during the Roman occupation of Celtic Britain, the still shot showed a black legionary. And Paul Joseph Watson was like, the Romans weren't black. This is BBC, like SJW, PC nonsense, yada, 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 yada. And the clip, the picture in the clip was an actual historical figure, the actual prelate or whatever the title was of London, Londinium at that point was from North Africa. It's like, no, I think you've got a wild misunderstanding of what the Roman Empire was like, because absolutely everyone in the empire came from absolutely everywhere in exactly the same way.
And in fact, yeah, I just wish people would pay more attention to history other than some facile television show they've watched, which hasn't given them a very good, you know, I mean, the Roman Empire is actually what essentially the British Empire is kind of based on. Yeah. And, you know, the Roman Empire classically, very cleverly did this thing of, you know, if you join our army and are in the army, you'll get citizenship. So every country that they colonized, you know, they had recruits who went into their army, and they were, it was incredibly diverse. And also the other problem is that the concept of race and how we view race wasn't viewed the same back then. So that's the other thing, that's not the same.
Yeah, there's been a lot of work in sort of the past 20 years on Black Tudors. Yeah. And how diverse London has been for a very, very long time. So, this kind of brings it actually round to talking about Victorians, because the notion of white England or white Britain is a Victorian myth where they were attempting to impose a view of their own superiority backwards through time.
Yeah.
While ignoring an awful lot of the evidence. So, it kind of brings it full circle. I just wanted to, relatively coming towards the end, but I still want to ask a few questions. One of the things, and this is one for Ian and Maura. This is based on a comic, which is based on a novel. So tell us a little bit about, Ian, particularly for you, where, because you've got an added element to this. This was a world you helped create. And you know, it was you and Matt playing around in HG Wells's world and getting to do what you want. What was the process like of essentially welcoming other writers into it in a different medium to the one that you've been working in?
Part of you get quite possessive and kind of thinking, oh, okay, you know, what are they going to do with it? And so the story, reading the stories, I tried to just take one sidestep to myself and go, okay, I want to try and read this as if I was just pick the book of itself and just and read them the stories first. And I enjoyed them all, basically. And like I say, there were some ideas and twists. I thought, oh, I wish I'd thought of that. That's kind of, it was quite inspirational in parts, because just thought, oh, okay, that's something I've not really thought of. It opens up another avenue or another direction. You do get kind of very possessive about it at first, because it's been your baby for so long. I spoke to Matt and said, well, you know, what do you think? Matt's being Matt just went, let me do what I like. Off they go. And he's like, you know, as long as I'm not drawing pictures, I don't mind. So,
as long as it's not my medium being messed with.
it just went, it's your baby, off you go. I was really pleased with the way it turned out. And it's just kind of nice that it's inspired such kind of tangential thoughts about the property. I mean, just things like, you know, Maura's story, Emma Beattie's story about a girl who becomes an engineer rebuilding toys and things. Everybody's come at stuff from a direction that I wouldn't really have imagined. What's helped is it's kind of like shaking me, because there's a tendency, if you're not careful with it, the story, to get into a bit of a rut, to retell the same tropes over and over again. And it was quite nice to actually see people coming at it from different directions with a fresh approach. It's been inspirational, I have to say.
Aww. Maura, what about you? Being invited into this world, which was you know, a comics world, and doing your prose thing. What was that like?
Oh, well, I write comics and prose, and I also do some playwriting. I work in lots of different media. And I do quite a bit of, you know, franchise work, as in I've written 2000 AD, Judge Anderson, and also I've written within Mike Mignola's world. So I always enter these worlds with respect for the creator. That's the number one thing. And I'm in there to do something interesting and have fun in somebody else's sandbox with their set of toys. In this case, I actually kind of created my own set of toys within the greater playground, to use that metaphor. So I wouldn't go in with the idea of I'm going to wreck this joint. It's more a case of I'm coming in here to add something and perhaps, the number one priority is tell an entertaining story. That's what I'm always trying to do first. And then after that, there's other things you can layer in. So yeah, I actually really enjoy coming in and working in other worlds. But sometimes you might be given certain directives about what you can and can't work with. But actually, I'm pretty okay with that most of the time because limits are useful because it makes it much easier, funny enough, to create a story because you can knock against them and then do odd things that people don't expect, you know.
And with a project like this, David, where we've got a variety of voices, explain a little bit about the relationship between you and Ian, because Ian's obviously finding people, commissioning people. Is it a case of just letting get on with it?
It's pretty hands-off. I work with a handful of anthologists and they give me a pitch. Sometimes they give me a number of pitches and I choose from them. I may talk with them a little bit to tweak the pitch. In this case, I mean, it's very straightforward. It's based on existing property. Ian came to me to sort of ask a bit about how many people he could invite, whether he should be aiming like entirely for sort of established writers or how many sort of new and up and coming writers he could invite in, asked me to suggest writers, which I did a couple of times. We talked a little bit about how exactly to put the collection together at the end, but really, aside from kind of answering questions and giving kind of little prods here and there, I let Ian very much up to it. My job is to take the final package at the end and deal with it, make it as polished as possible on its way out of the world.
Ian, now that the book is out, the project is done, what's your take on it? What's your view? Is this how you intended it to turn out, or has it surprised you?
I'm immensely proud. It looks beautiful. I mean, we haven't talked about it, but the cover design, and it's a hardback edition, so it's just beautiful. It's everybody who's had their, like, all the other authors who had their copies have remarked and, you know, on how impressive it looks, and they weren't expecting it to look so grandiose.
I thought that fight very early on, actually.
So I'm really pleased with the way he turned out. I mean, right for the days when I kind of pitched the idea to David, thinking he'd just take it and go off, you know, and he just turned around and went, okay, here's your budget, off you go. He's like, oh, okay. to now having the finished products in your hand, it's even my wife was impressed, and she doesn't impress greatly. So she was like, ooh. She went, it's a proper book.
Yeah, you hear that a lot in this line of work. Yeah.
It's a proper book. Yeah. So there you go. That's the word you can put it on the back. Brilliant. Jane Edgerton said, it's a proper book. That's the endorsement.
And so thinking ahead, is this something you'd like to repeat? Is there an angle that you'd like to take? Because obviously Scarlet Traces is going to be continuing in 2000 AD, and I believe there's another series coming up relatively soon. How do you take something like this forward? What's your next take?
What the numbers are like, you know, just being practical, and then possibly there are a number of authors who I wanted but couldn't make it, or and then other people have been in touch saying, we'd like to do something if there's another chance. So there's a you know, a roster kind of like half filled already if we do another one. I think, yeah, I mean, just see how this goes. It's just got to be pragmatic, see how this goes kind of financially and see what the critical, you know, if there's a critical acclaim or whatever, and we'll do another one. I quite fancy the idea of doing a stickleback one, I have to confess, which is the guy's the Pope of Crime in this kind of gothic-y, Gormenghast kind of London. And I'm thinking, I wouldn't mind doing one of those, but just see how it goes first, because obviously the Wells book you build on the original novel. So, it's time will tell.
Brilliant, brilliant. Well, speaking of time, I think we've come to the end of it. So I'll say thank you very much to David.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to Maura.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much to Ian.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The book is out now, available from Auger Booksellers.
Auger Booksellers, yes.
As well
it's
as...
it's a proper book.
It's a real proper book. Also available in ebook from the usual channels. Yep. And thank you very much indeed, everyone.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Great.
Cheers.
Fantastic. Cheers. Thanks very much, everyone. Appreciate it.
Okay. Bye.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
A huge thank you to Maura, Ian and David for chatting. Absolutely fascinating talk there. I hope you really enjoyed it. I certainly did. We've got more in 2 weeks' time. The droids are off to New York Comic Con, so you're going to be hearing plenty from there, no doubt. We've got a fantastic panel coming up, which is about war comics. Our friends at the Naval Institute in the US have joined with us to produce a panel with Garth Ennis, who many of you will know, along with Alex DeCampi and other voices from people who take the experiences of war, take war stories, create war stories, put them into comic books, and what war comics can and have revealed about the nature of conflict. Really looking forward to that. So hopefully be able to bring you a decent enough recording of that. Fingers crossed. Until next time, Earthlits, from everyone here at 2000 AD... Splendid Vertrig.
Alert! 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 Fill power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000adonline. And follow on Instagram at Insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down.